Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're zeroing in on a fascinating intersection of law and psychology through the lens of a pivotal case. United States v. Brown, a Tenth Circuit decision from 2003.
That's right. It's a really important one.
If you're looking to quickly and thoroughly grasp how a defendant's mental state plays out in criminal court, particularly, well, the tricky area of criminal intent, this case is absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm.
We've pulled together a rich set of resources for this discussion, detailed case analyses, standard legal briefs, even some initial thoughts on the complexities involved.
Good stuff to work with.
Our mission today is straightforward: to dissect the Tenth Circuit's ruling in Brown and pinpoint exactly what kind of mental health evidence can, and crucially, cannot be presented to argue that a defendant lacked the necessary criminal intent when they committed an alleged crime.
Exactly. This case isn't just about someone having a mental health condition. It's about how that condition relates directly to the specific mental requirements of the crime. The Brown ruling provides some really sharp distinctions that are key for anyone trying to understand this area of law.
Okay, let's get right into the heart of it with the case facts. What was the situation that brought Edward Brown before the court in the first place?
So Edward Brown was facing federal drug and firearm charges. Pretty serious stuff.
Okay.
His defense strategy centered on the argument that he didn't have the criminal intent required for these charges because he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
Ah, PTSD, okay.
And to support this, his legal team planned to have his psychologist, Dr. Lindberg, testify about how PTSD impacted his ability to make decisions.
But that testimony never actually reached the trial stage, did it? The district court blocked it.
Correct. The district court excluded Dr. Lindberg's testimony before the trial even began.
Why? What was their reasoning?
Their reasoning was that the proposed testimony didn't sufficiently connect Brown's PTSD to the specific intent required for the drug and firearm offenses he was charged with.
I see. So it wasn't a direct enough link in their view.
It's exactly. Following this ruling, Brown entered a guilty plea, but he strategically made it a conditional plea, preserving his right to appeal the district court's decision to exclude the psychologist's testimony.
Smart move.
Yeah, and that's what led the Tenth Circuit to take up the case.
So that sets up the central legal question we need to consider. Did the district court make the right call when they decided to exclude Dr. Lindberg's testimony?
Precisely. The Tenth Circuit had to determine whether this exclusion was legally sound under federal law, specifically concerning its relevance to mens rea lae, you know, the mental state necessary to commit a crime.
Right, the guilty mind.
Remember, the crucial point here isn't just whether Brown had PTSD, but whether his PTSD prevented him from forming the particular mental state required for the drug and firearm charges.
And this is where the Insanity Defense Reform Act, or IDRA, becomes so significant, yeah. Right? It really reshaped the landscape of how mental illness is considered in federal criminal cases.
Absolutely. Huge impact. Passed in 1984, IDRA dramatically narrowed the scope of the insanity defense in federal courts.
How so?
Well, before IDRA, some jurisdictions allowed an insanity defense based on an inability to conform one's conduct to the law, kind of a volitional control aspect.
Okay.
IDR changed that. Now, under federal law, a mental disease or defect can only be a defense if it meant the defendant couldn't understand the nature and quality of their actions, or that their actions were wrong.
And crucially.
And this must have been true at the time of the offense. So you see, the legal system is very specific here.
Very specific. Just having a diagnosis isn't enough.
Right. Simply having a mental illness doesn't get you off the hook unless it directly impacted your understanding of right and wrong at the moment the crime was committed.
That's a much more limited scope than it used to be.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, IDRA also puts restrictions on using mental illness evidence for other purposes in a criminal trial.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
A really critical part of IDRA is that it prevents the introduction of mental illness evidence solely to show what's often called reduced capacity. If that reduced capacity isn't tied to this very specific definition of insanity, the inability to understand the nature, quality, or wrongfulness of one's actions.
Okay.
This is a cornerstone for understanding why the court ruled the way it did in the Brown case.
Now, when we talk about criminal law, we often distinguish between specific intent and general intent crimes. Could you clarify that distinction for us? It feels like it's a key piece of this puzzle.
Certainly. Specific intent crimes are those where the defendant must have a particular mental state or purpose in mind when they commit the act.
Okay, like planning something out.
Yeah, think about conspiracy, where you have to intend to agree with someone else to commit an illegal act,
mm-hmm.
or premeditated murder, which involves a deliberate intention to kill.
Got it.
General intent crimes, on the other hand, don't require this same level of purposeful mental state. Simple assault, maybe, where the intent to make contact might be enough, even without the intent to cause serious harm. That could be an example.
Okay, that distinction makes sense. So, where does mental health evidence typically fit into this framework of specific versus general intent?
Generally, evidence of mental illness is considered more relevant when we're dealing with specific intent crimes.
Makes sense.
The argument is that a mental condition might impair someone's ability to form that particular purposeful mental state required for a specific intent crime.
Right.
However, and this is where Brown provides crucial guidance even in specific intent crimes, the mental health evidence has to directly address that specific intent element. It can't be vague.
Which brings us back to why Dr. Lindberg's testimony was excluded in Brown's case. It wasn't just about Brown having PTSD. It was about the content of what the psychologist was going to say, right?
Yeah, precisely. The court scrutinized the substance of the proposed testimony very carefully. What was Dr. Lindberg actually going to testify about?
And what was it?
Well, his assessment focused on Brown's general inability to make lawful choices and to conform his actions to the requirements of the law because of his PTSD.
Mm.
The court's perspective was that this line of reasoning, essentially, I couldn't control myself or I couldn't make the right decisions due to my condition, is essentially an excuse or a justification for the criminal behavior.
And that's a crucial difference from saying I didn't actually intend to commit the crime, isn't it?
Exactly. Huge difference legally. This is where the legal concepts of justification and mens rea become so important.
Right.
A justification or excuse argues that even if the act occurred and the mental state was present, there's a reason why the defendant shouldn't be held fully responsible. Negating mens rea, on the other hand, means arguing that a necessary element of the crime, the required mental state, was simply never present.
Okay, so the element itself is missing.
Exactly. The court in Brown concluded that the defense was attempting to use Dr. Lindberg's testimony to offer an excuse based on Brown's impaired control, rather than demonstrating that he lacked the specific intent to distribute drugs or use a firearm.
So, like you said, it's arguing I couldn't help myself versus arguing I didn't actually mean to do that.
That's a great way to put it. That captures the essence of the court's distinction.
So the Tenth Circuit wasn't saying that mental health evidence can never be used to argue a lack of intent, but it has to meet a very specific and high standard.
Definitely not a complete ban.
And from this case, they actually developed a three-part test to determine when such evidence can be admitted for that purpose, correct?
Yes, that's a key contribution of the Brown ruling, a very useful framework. The Tenth Circuit established a clear three-part test that mental health evidence must meet to be admissible for the purpose of negating specific intent.
Okay, what are the parts?
First, the evidence must be based on a legally acceptable theory for negating intent. This means it has to be aimed at showing the defendant didn't form the required mental state, not just that they had a reason for acting the way they did.
So theory matters. Got it.
Second, the evidence must clearly demonstrate how the specific mental condition actually undermined the specific intent required for the particular crime the defendant is charged with.
Needs to be specific and clear.
Right. It's not enough to simply state that they have a condition. The testimony must clearly explain the causal link. How did this condition prevent that intent?
Makes sense. And the third part?
And third, and this is absolutely critical, the evidence cannot focus on volitional control. That is, the defendant's alleged inability to stop themselves from acting or to conform their conduct to the law.
There's that control issue again.
Exactly. That's the line drawn by IDRA that the court reinforced.
And in Brown's case, the proposed testimony didn't quite measure up to these criteria, especially those second and third points, it sounds like.
Precisely. The court found that Dr. Lindberg's testimony primarily focused on Brown's difficulties in making lawful choices and controlling his behavior due to PTSD.
Uh-huh.
It didn't clearly explain how his PTSD prevented him from forming the specific intent to, for example, conspire to distribute methamphetamine or to knowingly use a firearm in furtherance of drug trafficking.
It didn't connect those dots clearly enough.
Exactly. Because the testimony leaned so heavily on the issue of volitional control and inability to conform his conduct to the law, it was deemed inadmissible under the framework established by IDRA and this three-part test.
So for a defendant facing criminal charges who wants to use mental health evidence to argue they lacked intent, what are the practical implications of this ruling? What's the core message they need to understand?
The most important takeaway for defendants is that this case sets a very high bar. It's not easy. Simply presenting evidence of a mental health condition isn't going to be sufficient.
Just having the diagnosis isn't enough.
Definitely not. They absolutely must be able to directly link that condition to the specific intent element of the crime they're charged with.
How would that work? Maybe give an example.
Sure. If someone with PTSD is accused of conspiracy, they would need to present expert testimony that specifically explains how their PTSD, maybe intrusive thoughts or hypervigilance, prevented them from forming the agreement with others to commit the crime, or from having the specific intent to achieve the unlawful goal of the conspiracy.
Okay, so a very direct causal chain.
Yes. Brown makes it clear that arguing, "I couldn't control myself," or "my PTSD made me do it," is very likely to be seen as an excuse or justification, not as evidence that the required mental state was absent. The court will likely shut that down.
And for legal professionals who are trying to present this kind of evidence, what's the key lesson they should take away from the Brown case?
For lawyers, Brown underscores the critical need to frame mental health evidence very narrowly and strategically. You have to be surgical.
How so?
They must ensure that the expert testimony is laser-focused on how the defendant's mental condition specifically negated the required mens rea for the crime. They need to actively avoid broad claims about impaired judgment or a lack of control.
Because that falls into the inadmissible category.
Exactly, as those arguments are very likely to be deemed inadmissible. There's a significant risk of confusing the jury if the evidence isn't clearly and directly tied to the legal definition of intent.
Right, juries might get sidetracked.
Precisely. Attorneys need to be prepared to articulate precisely how the mental condition prevented the formation of the specific mental state required for the crime, or they risk having their evidence excluded by the court.
It sounds like careful preparation with the expert witness is crucial.
Absolutely essential. As that hypothetical podcast excerpt we looked at earlier put it succinctly, the crucial question to constantly ask when evaluating potential mental health testimony is, does this evidence target intent or is it just an excuse?
That's a really good litmus test, intent or excuse. Okay, let's delve a little deeper into the specifics of the court's reasoning by looking at the detailed case brief we have. What were the most significant points that the Tenth Circuit emphasized when they upheld the exclusion of Dr. Lindbergh's testimony?
Well, the court's reasoning was heavily grounded in the Insanity Defense Reform Act, IDRA. They repeatedly emphasized that the proposed testimony from Dr. Lindbergh simply didn't address Brown's capacity to form the mens rea for the drug and firearm offenses he was charged with.
It just missed the mark on intent.
Yeah, fundamentally. The court pointed out that the testimony instead focused on Brown's perceived inability to conform his conduct to the law, that issue of volitional control again.
Right.
Which, as we've discussed, isn't a valid basis for negating mens rea under IDRA.
Okay.
Furthermore, the Tenth Circuit highlighted that Brown's legal team didn't provide any additional evidence or legal arguments to bridge that crucial gap to specifically connect his PTSD to a lack of the required criminal intent for those particular charges. They just didn't make that specific connection.
So the evidence offered just wasn't sufficient to meet the legal standard. And the standard brief we have also distills this, well, it's a pretty complex case, down to some really essential points. What are the key takeaways from that more concise summary of the ruling?
The standard brief does a good job. It effectively highlights the core rule of law that emerged from Brown. Psychological evidence can be admissible to negate specific intent, but only if it's based on a legally sound theory and clearly demonstrates that it undermines that specific intent.
The two key conditions.
Yes, and it absolutely cannot be centered on a general impairment of volitional control. The central issue, as the brief clearly frames it, is precisely whether and how evidence of a mental condition can be admitted to negate specific intent and what the clear legal limitations on that admissibility are.
Got it. What about the opinions and analysis?
Well, the opinions section of the brief underscores the court's central finding, that Dr. Lindbergh's proposed testimony didn't establish a link between Brown's PTSD and the specific intent required for drug trafficking and firearm offenses. Instead, it focused on that inability to conform his conduct to legal requirements.
Same theme again.
Exactly. And the analysis section emphasizes the critical need for courts to carefully and critically examine such evidence to prevent jury confusion and to ensure that it genuinely negates intent, rather than simply offering a psychological explanation or excuse for criminal behavior.
The standard brief also pulls out a particularly instructive quote directly from the Tenth Circuit's ruling, doesn't it?
It does indeed. A very telling quote. The key quote is, "Psychological or psychiatric evidence that negates the essential element of specific intent can be admissible."
Okay, so it can be done.
It can be. But, and this is the absolutely critical follow-up from the court, the evidence that Brown offered in this case simply did not meet that established legal standard.
Didn't clear the hurdle.
Nope. The brief also reiterates the crucial three-part test that we discussed earlier and concludes with a central takeaway. The Tenth Circuit ultimately upheld the exclusion of the testimony because the proposed evidence focused on Brown's alleged impaired control, not on a demonstrable lack of specific intent for the crimes he was charged with.
So, as we bring this deep dive to a close, what is the most crucial insight from United States v. Brown that our listeners, especially law students, should remember?
I think the central and absolutely critical insight from United States v. Brown is the sharp and legally significant distinction that the law draws between evidence that directly negates the specific mental state required for a particular crime.
Mens rea.
And evidence that merely offers an explanation or excuse for unlawful behavior based on a mental health condition affecting a person's ability to control their own actions. Volitional control.
That core distinction again?
Absolutely. The Tenth Circuit's ruling makes it unequivocally clear that while mental health evidence can be relevant to the question of whether someone formed the necessary criminal intent, it must directly target that specific element of intent and not simply provide a reason why they may have acted unlawfully due to an impairment in their volitional control.
That's a really crucial distinction and a vital point for anyone interested in understanding the complexities at the intersection of criminal law and mental health. It highlights that the legal system, while acknowledging the potential impact of mental illness, has very specific rules about how that impact can be considered when determining criminal culpability.
Exactly. It's about fitting the evidence into the specific legal boxes required by the law, particularly after IDRA.
Now, just as a final thought to leave our listeners with, considering this ruling in Brown, how might evolving understandings of mental health, you know, neuroscience, psychology, and its impact on cognitive functions potentially influence future legal interpretations of criminal intent?
That's a fascinating question.
And maybe, what are the ethical considerations of drawing such a firm line, as the law currently does, between lacking intent and lacking control, especially when modern science might see those concepts as more intertwined?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? As science gives us a more nuanced view of how conditions like PTSD affect brain function, decision-making, impulse control, will the law adapt? Or will that strict IDRA framework hold firm? It pits legal definitions against evolving scientific understanding. Definitely something to keep an eye on.
Definitely food for thought. Thank you for this incredibly insightful deep dive.
My pleasure. It's a critical case to understand.